Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to another edition of Solutions Watch. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you in July of 2025 with some great news, or great news if you happen to be a 9/11 research nerd like myself. At any rate, the 9/11 timeline is back. I know. I'll leave you a second to stop cheering and hollering from the peanut gallery there. Well, all right, maybe some people in the crowd don't know about the 9/11 timeline, what it is, why it's important, or more importantly, even in all of that, how to use it. But if not, don't worry. That's what Solutions Watch is here to provide. A very, very useful research tool that you will be able to make use of if you are at all interested in researching various aspects of 9/11. So in order to talk about this development, we're going to bring the man responsible for this development on. He is Ted Walter, who you will remember from our previous conversations here on the Corbett Report, if not from his work at the International Center for 9/11 Justice at ic911.org. But let's bring him on to talk about the 9/11 timeline. Ted, thank you very much for joining us again today.
Hey, James. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you again.
Yes, and it's good to be talking about something, well, I think positive. I mean, maybe on the big scheme of things, this isn't exactly the achievement of 9/11 justice, but it is an important thing. Specifically, it is the 9/11 timeline. And I have talked about this in the past and how incredibly important a research tool it is. But that research tool has been missing for several years, and it is now coming back thanks to the International Center for 9/11 Justice. I want to talk about all of that, but just to make sure everyone is on the same page, let's start with talking about what the complete 9/11 timeline, as I believe the official title is, what that is, where it comes from, and what it does. I will direct people to your recent post up on ic911.org. The indispensable complete 9/11 timeline is back. Spread the word. And I hope people will take a look at that and indeed spread the word. But let's get it straight from yourself. What is the 9/11 timeline? Where and how did it originate? Did it originate? And what is it good for?
Sure. I first want to say that I feel not that responsible for this thing being alive again, being on our website, and just existing. I think the International Center for 9/11 Justice and myself are playing a relatively small role compared to the enormous amount of work that was done to compile this timeline over many years. So I just want to honor the team of people that worked on this timeline, that created it and, you know, poured their blood, sweat, and tears into it. And we are very fortunate and very honored to have it on ic911.org now. Basically the timeline started back in 2001 or 2002, and it started at the Center for Cooperative Research, by Derek Mitchell. And around the same time on his own, Paul Thompson, who's a well-known 9/11 researcher, started kind of compiling his own timeline based on all like mainstream news reports, and other documents that he was able to gather. And then this both these things happened in like around 2001. And by early 2002, I think Paul Thompson stumbled upon the timeline project that Cooperative Research was creating and basically said, I would love to work with you. I'd love to if you could host the timeline that I'm putting together here. And basically the goal was to like meticulously that when you zoomed out enough and looked at all the news reports that were out there, you could actually piece together a very different narrative or a lot more interesting narrative than what was being presented in the news. And so that's what Paul Thompson and Derek Mitchell and others proceeded to do over the following years. I know in 2000, you know, it grew a lot just in those early years from 2001 to 2004. And then Paul Thompson came out with a book, The Terror Timeline, which was very well received even in the mainstream. And, you know, there's many mainstream journalists who've used this tool over the years. Of course, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of very serious 9/11 researchers have used it as well, but have used the tool over the years. And what it ultimately does, it just makes it incredibly easy for you to find pretty much every mainstream news report or important document or whatever that's out there on any event that is publicly known that any individual participated in, all the different 9/11 related events that, say, a Donald Rumsfeld or a Dick Cheney was involved in. You can go through, you can basically click on their name and just get a readout of events throughout the course of the day on 9/11 and prior to 9/11, after 9/11 that they were involved in. So it's basically, there's something like just, and I want to clarify this, just the complete 9/11 timeline itself has something like 7,300 entries. So an entry will be like a chunk of text, and then it'll have, you know, very well sourced throughout all the facts that are being stated. And at the bottom, there's entity tags and category tags where you can link to other things, et cetera. But then also the Center for Cooperative Research, which became the History Commons, has many other timelines as well, something like 30 other timelines. And you can actually link to those from our website as well. They're stored on archive.org or in the Wayback Machine. But the complete 9/11 timeline itself is available and searchable on our website. But those other timelines still are available. They're just, it's a little slower on archive.org. So.
It certainly is. And I must say, it's been years since the History Commons hosting of this database went down. And it has, it really was a travesty because it was such a handy tool and a good way of finding information. But rather than talking about it, why don't we take a look at it? So, of course, I will link up this indispensable complete 9/11 timeline is back, spread the word, where you talk about the timeline, what it is, and more importantly, provide a link to check out the complete timeline. So once you do, you will get here to this front page, which again explains a little bit about the timeline. There's the search bar, there are key events, day of 9/11, alleged hijackers, all of these different categories of things that you can search through that way, and you can click into any of them, like Bayoumi and Baznan, Saudi connection, and you can find information about that. But I always tend to have something in particular that I'm searching for, so why don't we try the capabilities of this? And so, Ted, let me put you on the spot. Several years ago, I remember chasing down, everyone remembers in the 9/11 Truth community, remembers the story that Mineta told, Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta told, about the young staffer who was coming into the PEOC, the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, and telling Vice President Cheney, the plane is 50 miles out, the plane is 20 miles out, the plane is 10 miles out, do the orders still stand? And he whipped his head around and said, of course they still stand, did you hear anything to the contrary? I'm sure everyone in my long-term audience remembers that story because it's happened many times. And I remember tracking down the name of that staffer who was coming in and talking to Dick Cheney, giving him those updates. Do you happen to know that name?
Well, many people believe it's Douglas Cochran. Is that the name, yes, that you have?
Yeah, that is exactly right. That's the name I remember.
Yeah, and some people question that. I don't know if those people.
Fair enough.
I don't know for sure if those people have somebody else in mind in particular, but they question that for certain reasons.
Let's see what the 9/11 timeline has to say. So if you type in Cochran, suddenly we are between 10:10 a.m. and 10:18 a.m. September 11th. Vice President Cheney authorized the military to shoot down a suspicious plane approaching Washington, and of course it has all of this information, including, let's do a Command F search for Mineta. Oh, Mineta is not in here, but Cochran, presumably, will be in here. Douglas Cochran, Vice President, Chief, Military Aide, joins Cheney in underground tunnel. Cochran went from the White House to his office in the Eisenhower Executive Building, etc., blah, blah, blah. All of this information. Where does this come from? Oh, okay, 9/11 Commission, 4/16/2004. And it links to the actual document itself, this handwritten interview notes from the 9/11 Commission talking to Doug Cochran, VP Military Aide. There's more, of course, other entries, other things in which Cochran is referenced or in which he appears as an entity, and all of the things that are cited in here are similarly sourced, so you can go and click through. So for people who have never used this, it is an incredible resource, and it is incredibly important for researchers who are serious about actually drilling down on the details to have this. And of course, I understand that people out there will suddenly be like, whoa, these are all mainstream sources. Yes, this is the point. If there is something that is listed, if there's something, some name or some event that comes from somewhere, and you can go directly to the source, and then you can adjudicate for yourself whether that is a reliable source or not, and the context in which that information appears, etc., etc. That is the essence of the open source investigation that the Corbett Report is devoted to. So I cannot stress how incredibly important this is. And it really is, again, just this name, Cochran, and you can suddenly drill down on this particular aspect of 9/11. Ted, let me put you on the spot once again. What do you want to search? Any search term related to anything vaguely 9/11 related. Let's see if the timeline can provide.
Well, since we launched the timeline on Thursday, I have used it many times. One of the people that I've used it to search for is Richard Rotans. He was the deputy director of the Office of Emergency Management.
I'm not even familiar with that name. Rotens? So,
with a Z, with a Z.
With a Z. All right.
Yep.
Emergency Management Deputy Director Rotens sees significant damage inside World Trade Center Building 7. So he was the, part of the New York's Office of Emergency Management, presumably working with people like Barry Jennings?
I don't know if he... I would say there's a decent chance he knew Barry Jennings. But yeah. it would be like a distant associate, let's say.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Barry Jennings worked for the New York City Housing Authority.
You're right. But still, he was in the OEM on the morning of 9/11. Right?
He's somebody who would be called into the OEM in an actual emergency. So
yeah. All right. Tell me about Rotens. Tell me about the significance of this.
Well, there's a lot of things. One thing I just need to do a little quality control here myself, because I know we put a lot of work into making sure that things laid out chronologically. But when I'm seeing this search return here, I'm seeing, okay, after 10:12:30 after. Oh.
This is reverse chronological.
Yeah, something happened here. So we're still working out the kinks. But yep. I will say what you can do is click on Rotens. I'll explain a little bit more about him and why he's interesting. But if you click on like any of these, click on any of these individual entries. So you can actually click on it.
Yeah.
And then you'll see those entity tags. Yeah,
Richard Rotens.
Click on Rotens from there.
Okay.
Right. And then you'll get a nicer layout. And that is... That is chronological.
That's chronological. Yeah. Okay.
Fingers crossed. Anyway, so all these things that Rotens was involved in throughout the day, he was involved in a lot of interesting situations. He was involved in the decision to evacuate Building 7 early in the morning, shortly after, let's say, the second airplane attack at the World Trade Center. He was involved in receiving advice from an engineer at the site that who was there in the lobby of Building 7 that the towers were going to come down. And they started transmitting that warning to various people. And so that whoever was making that prediction just happened to be correct. And we're still trying to figure out who that engineer was. He was also then involved, you know, he was in the sort of huddle of, you know, senior level fire department officials who started saying that Building 7 is going to come down later today. They were also advised by an engineer, possibly the same engineer, that Building 7 was going to come down later in the day, based on the damage or the fires that it sustained. And lastly, Rotens himself, this is probably documented in there, went inside Building 7 up to the 8th floor in the early afternoon and actually observed a huge amount of damage to the interior of the building, including two elevator cars actually ejected from the elevator shafts. And he has said that the elevator shafts themselves were just, didn't exist. They were blown open. So he's a firsthand witness to an incredible amount of damage to the interior of Building 7, which is not really compatible with debris hitting the building. So he was involved in a lot of interesting situations. And so that's all throughout the day of 9/11. And that's
He also sees an elevator car that was blown out of the shaft and is now down the hall. And we have two different links for that relating to BBC, the Third Tower, of course, documentary that people will be familiar with. Presumably he is on the record saying that in that. And here's the Conspiracy Files documents as well. So again, you can follow each thing back down to its actual source. Where and when and in what context did Richard Rotens report this? And yeah, often you don't have to go to some strange conspiracy site. You can send your friend to, hey, the BBC, here's a BBC documentary interview with Richard Rotens talking about this. That's pretty strange, don't you think? I wonder what that means. Again, an incredible resource, not only for people who are making documentaries about 9/11 like myself, but for people who want to demonstrate various points about that day and have the sources to back them up. My mind boggles. I speak for a living, and yet I can barely state how important it is to have access to this information, this database. And as you say, so what you've done is you've taken the guts of the database and you are displaying it within ic911.org right now. Yep. And it is formatting it and hopefully making it readable and accessible, but essentially it's the guts of that database, which has been preserved. I have a local copy that I have access to and I've been using, and this is why I want to give you props for doing this, because yes, certainly, absolute props should go to the many dedicated researchers and individuals who made this database and contributed to it over the years and made it into this incredible resource of thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of entries. That's an incredible feat. But hosting it is no minor thing either, because as I say, I've had that local copy that I've had for years now, and I've for years been contemplating, I should get a domain and I should host this and put it up again so that people can access it. But it has always been at the bottom of my very long to-do list. And finally, yes, someone has come along to do that. And wow, hats off to you for doing this. Thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome. When we started the International Center for 9/11 Justice, it was about 2 years ago. You know, it was basically our mission to start to really organize and preserve all the various kinds of evidence that was out there, a huge amount of both, you know, papers and all of that. And bring together the Journal of 9/11 Studies and the 9/11 Consensus Panel and other, you know, the Toronto hearings, but also the complete 9/11 timeline. Getting that going again was very much at the top of our list, and we contacted those guys and said, "What can we do to help get this going again? Can we form some sort of a partnership here, or maybe because it seemed like funding had been the issue, which I understand that to be the case." And said, "Maybe we can help you get some funding and." Whatever, let's do this. Took a little while, but you know, like, and there was initial discussion, but essentially, like, last fall, like a year and a half later, Derek just reached out to me and said, like, you know, rather than just bringing back the center, what he had done, he said, "I'm looking for a place to store it. You know, can we bring it over to your website?" And so that started getting going last October, November, and here we are, you know, eight months later. And the web team that we have, you know, they made it look easy. I'm not sure how I just gave feedback on what they were doing. They made it look super easy, scraping a bunch of stuff and there it is. So,
perhaps some of the kinks still need to be ironed out with chronological and what have you, but at any rate, the data is there and accessible. Now, one of the other aspects of this project, which made it so amazing, and I think there was a quote from, let me not butcher this. I will bring it up live here. I believe I saw a quote. Yes, David Ray Griffin, the late, great David Ray Griffin, said, described this as the greatest feat of annotated investigative journal indexing ever achieved on a volunteer basis. And it certainly is that. It is a truly remarkable feat that could only have happened in this internet age. But it was, when it was previously hosted at History Commons, it was a wiki-style project where anyone could contribute and add, and there would be people who would edit and make sure that the entries were correct and all of that. Is that aspect, A, functional right now, or B, perhaps something that will be added in the future?
So it's definitely not functional right now. This is very much like an archive of the work that team did. But we... You know, we haven't ruled out trying to make it. I mean, trying to make it more, yeah, like where people from different locations can work on it, or at least putting together a big team of volunteers who are at least willing to work on it through a single portal on our site. I think it, you know, and Derek himself, I can't remember if it's Derek or somebody else. Maybe it was Derek who suggested the idea of getting AI. To be combing the internet for both old information and new information related to any of these events or any other 9/11 related events, and basically draft an entry. We would review it, of course. It won't just automatically publish, but
yeah.
Scour the internet, draft it, get all the links, get all the sources, and then propose it as an entry. So I don't know. Maybe that can work. We haven't explored it yet.
I'm going to guess there's going to be some very controversial feedback on that particular aspect of it and what ChatGPT may or may not be able to tell us about the events of 9/11. But I am excited at the very least. This is preserved. It is here. This work has not been lost. So thankfully, the diligent work of all of those researchers over those many years putting together these thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of links and resources has been preserved. Thank God. For that. And now it's a question of what we do with this information. And of course, a resource like this is only as good as whatever people make of it. So if people are interested in really deep diving into 9/11 research, here is a tool that is now in your tool belt. Use it wisely. Having said that, again, people might may or may not be familiar with the International Center for 9/11 Justice, depending how up they are on our previous interviews, let alone following the space generally. If for people who don't know, tell us about IC911.org.
Yeah, so I mean, it's basically, it was originally called the International Center for 9/11 Studies, and it was formed back in 2008 by an attorney named James Gourley, who is still on our board of directors. And they were, you know, they were involved in research efforts back in those days, particularly around the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings. But I think the major thing they did in that time period was host the Toronto hearings in 2011, and then a year later produced the Toronto hearings report. And then there was some documentaries that came out after that, about the Toronto hearings. And they also were, involved in getting this huge release, FOIA release of, videos and photos and so on from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I would say the other major thing that they did in those early years. And so basically it went largely dormant after, 2014 or so. But I approached James and others who are kind of associated with it about rebooting it, last 2 years ago, and bringing it together with the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which has published something like 150 peer-reviewed papers and letters, since 2006. Some of the most important seminal 9/11 papers are in the journal, as well as the 9/11 consensus panel. And so all that research is available on the website, in one place. But also we do, and so we continue to publish stuff in the Journal of 9/11 Studies and the Debated Topics Forum. But we're also very involved in public outreach, public education, and legal initiatives, such as the ongoing legal effort in the UK by the family of Jeff Campbell to get a new inquest into Jeff's death in the North Tower, on 9/11. And so, yeah, kind of all of the above, research, education, and action. I just want to say how grateful I am for you immediately picking this up and helping to get the word out that this timeline is available, for people to use. Like, I just like, once it's up there, I just want as many people to know, because I know that it was a very cherished resource for so many years. And I just hope it spreads like wildfire, that people find out that it's back and that people can use it. I've never felt this much urgency to get the word out almost about anything that we've done in the 2 years. So thank you very much.
I'm not faking my enthusiasm. This has been a truly valuable tool to me over the years. So I'm very glad to see it's back. And again, yes, it is what people make of it. But having said that, the reason that the original History Commons posted version of this ultimately ended up going the way of the dodo was, as you say, largely because of monetary concerns and the upkeep and et cetera. So it is not a minor thing to be keeping this repository going and accessible online. So for people who are interested in supporting you and your efforts, and not just this, but all of the things that IC911 is doing, how can they do that? And if people are interested in following your updates and what's going on with the International Center for 9/11 Justice, how can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you see on our website there, right where the complete 9/11 timeline is, you can subscribe right at the top. There's a button for that. And you can subscribe to our email list, or you can subscribe to us on Substack. And then there's a donation button there in the top right. It will go a long way. We are very active right now, and there's a lot happening in 9/11 truth right now. I think we've perhaps started to turn a corner here, as you've written about in recent months, kind of the Overton window is moving. If you want to interpret that in a positive way, I think, which I do, a lot is happening. So please support the work of this organization if you can. Thank you.
I would say that the act of spreading 9/11 truth, people have never been more receptive to at least listening to this than they are right now. And it has been raised by some high profile figures in recent months. So I think there is actually momentum for the first time behind this in a long time. So I'm very excited about that. Very excited about this resource. Very excited to see what else will be coming from the International Center for 9/11 Justice in the future. But I think we'll leave this conversation there for today. Ted Walter, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your efforts.
Thank you, James. And thanks for all that you do.